Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. I'm your co-host, Ron Edwards, coming to you on a beautiful Saturday afternoon here in the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. I'll be sitting in by myself as co-host Donald Allen is traveling in the eastern part of the United States. But this is On Point, part of Black Politics and Black Political, if you will. We're going to take a look at a number of issues this afternoon that will be certainly under the microscope during 2013, as, of course, we wind down the year 2012, a year that will go down in the annals of history-making, if you will, with the second term of America's first African-American president, Barack Obama. But we're looking at a multiplicity of problems, and we're still feeling the heartache here in the United States for our international audience with respect to the events at Newtown, Connecticut, just a little over a week ago, actually yesterday, when a gunman, some who say that he was crazed and out of his mind, but certainly he was calculating, he was well-armed, weapons that had been purchased by his mother, who he murdered. She, in fact, appears to be his first victim on that horrific Friday morning just a week ago yesterday. But that will probably come and go and pass. But in the meanwhile, we hear some of the ridiculous by those on the extreme right who are doing everything they can to keep the wolf away from the front door, if you will, of gun control and the future of how well Americans will be armed. And we are well armed in this country. Over 300 million guns is what is being said. We are a well-armed nation, if you will. And as an African-American, I can tell you we as a group, as Black America, have felt the sting of a heavily armed white, quote-unquote, opposition that desires to impose its will, its anger, its frustration, its white rage against the interest of the sons and daughters of the African. And so this is not new to us, this pain that is being felt now across the nation and in some parts of the world, the loss of 20 innocent children, 7 adults, including the 6 killed in the school at Sandy Hook, the principal and other administrators. And we know that there is a debate, which we find interesting, about should the mother of the monster be included as a victim. Certainly she should be included. She was a victim. There is no evidence that she had any role whatsoever in the carnage that took place in that small Connecticut town, Newtown, Connecticut. And so clearly there were 27 victims, 26 at the school, and 1 in her home, while in her bed, if you will. But it is now the absurd and the ridiculous, if you will, that we are hearing from the violent right in America. The president of the National Rifle Association yesterday proposing that every school in America, and by the way, I don't know if that includes charter schools or alternative schools, and et cetera, but have an armed guard. He said a policeman, if you will. I'm not sure that America has that many police officers to spare to have one on duty 8, 10, 11 hours a day, 5 days a week. And, of course, if there are extracurricular activities at these institutions during the night, if you will, which many of our schools have, particularly those in the so-called suburban and rural areas of America, what will be the overall cost? Of course, what Lafayette said, the head of the National Rifle Association, that cost should be no prohibition. There should be no prohibition. No cost should be spared in America to protect our schools and our children. Of course, by engaging Americans in that kind of discussion, the NRA stays away from that which is its most important role as lobbyists for, quote-unquote, a well-armed America. And by the way, we do talk in terms of a well-armed America based on the color of skin. You see, that's the elephant that's in the room that no one really wants to discuss. When folks say how terrified they are about, quote-unquote, a threat to their safety, unfortunately, in this country, the United States of America, race becomes a significant part of that discussion, that apprehension, that fear, that anger, that rage, that we are, quote-unquote, arming ourselves against the dark peril, if you will, the dark cloud that we see sweeping in from the so-called urban centers of America. But then in parts of rural America, particularly in the South and some parts of the North, where there are African Americans who reside in these hamlets and enclaves, if you will, in the countryside of America, they are seen as, quote-unquote, the enemy, the dark scourge, if you will. And so we say here at on this program and at this particular time that we feel that until such time as we are prepared to talk about race, if you will, and what really, quote-unquote, terrifies us. Because you see, as a black American, if I were to say that I'm in favor of being able to keep my guns, if you will, and I'm a member of the National Rifle Association, have been since the 1960s, if you will, when as young African Americans or Negroes, we understood the importance during the period of uprisings in America, as the Black Revolution, the Black Insurgency began to emerge, as Black Americans began to say that enough was enough. There were factions of us, though, that understood the importance of nestling in to, quote-unquote, the National Rifle Association, and some would be surprised at how many black chapters of the National Rifle Association. Sometimes we would even solicit a Caucasian, if you will, have them fill out the application and membership, if you will. We would even sometimes take on Caucasian-sounding names for our, quote-unquote, NRA chapters in our respective neighborhoods, communities, and et cetera. And so black Americans understood many years ago, and in the course of being able to nestle in, if you will, you sometimes got the right kind of literature, if you will. You heard the right kinds of discussions. Sometimes we would send surrogates, if you will, operatives, to the national NRA conferences and regionals and et cetera, gun shows and such things as that. All that was necessary was to play the role of, quote-unquote, a black man who understood that black people, his own kind, were the danger that threatened, quote-unquote, the viability of a white America, if you will, and that we, quote-unquote, loved the National Rifle Association. We loved the American flag. We loved the doctrine. Of course, we didn't, if you will. And in fact, as we said just minutes ago, this modus operandi was in place and has been in place for almost 50 years. And so we understand that one of the things that will not be debated in an honest manner with appropriate transparency is who is the real threat. Is it the Russians, if you will? We love the Russians, if we will. They're our trading partners now. We love the Chinese, who were communists, if you will. The Russians clearly were communists. I mean, the doctrine of communism, if you will, Leninism and Stalinism and et cetera, came out of, quote, on the heartland of the motherland, if you will. Is it the little yellow man of China that we are threatened by? Is it the little yellow man of Vietnam, if you will, or Indonesia, if you will? Or is it the black man of Africa, if you will? Or is it the brown-skinned people of South America, if you will, of Ecuador, Peru, all through the Andes and into Chile, if you will, but particularly Brazil? Or is it the blacks of the islands of the Caribbean, if you will? Haiti, if you will, Jamaica, Trinidad, Tobago. You know what we're saying here. Or is it our neighbors to the south, the Mexicans, if you will, the lords of drug traffic and significant violence, particularly along the Rio Grande, along America's southern border, if you will, with its Mexican neighbors and all of that that unfortunately goes with the violence. I'm not sure. We never had that discussion. In fact, one of the things that we will do, we will provide a alternate phone number. We are available at 763-228-1748. Again, the phone number for call in, 763-228-1748. Again, this is On Point, if you will, Black Political, if you will. I'm the co-host, Ron Edwards. My associate, Mr. Allen, as we said earlier, is traveling in the eastern United States to enjoy the holidays. And, of course, we wish everyone the best and the safest, and certainly this is needed in light of what happened, quote-unquote, in central Pennsylvania, if you will, where we saw a situation where, and hold on just a minute, we may have a call. Hello?
Blasio Casino there, Mr. Allen. Mayor CC is trying to open up Blasio Casino on Christmas Day. Is this true, sir?
You know, sir, on that question, we have no knowledge at this point. That would be something that Mr. Allen was involved in. We have no idea, and I'm not quite sure that I'm understanding a casino. We have no casino in Minneapolis. We have a casino, a big casino called Mystic Lake. But what casino is this the mayor was talking about opening? Oh, no, no. Block E, which was is a major facility in the heart of downtown Minneapolis, is dead. I mean, nothing has happened. The mayor thought that they were going to utilize Block E to help pay off the Viking, the city's debt for the building of the Viking Stadium. The city will have an initial debt of $150 million, and then over the next 30 years, about $845 million, which the taxpayers of the city of Minneapolis will be required to absorb. I assume that's what Mr. Allen was talking about. And let me just repeat the question, sir. The caller has asked the question about we are going to begin to recruit firefighters here in the city of Minneapolis. To the caller's question, we know there's been a lot of loose talk about continuing to integrate what is by size, the most diverse fire department in the United States, the Minneapolis Fire Department. But to the caller's question, no, there will not be a preponderance of African Americans, Negroes, Blacks, or however people like to refer to us. Probably as many as 8,000 will make application, doing a very, very small window, if you will. But because there is no diversity plan, and because there is no court oversight, as was during the time that, and I have to indicate that for 20 years, I served as the overseer, and for 11 Pacific years served as the overseer on behalf of the federal court in the integration of the Minneapolis Fire Department starting in 1968. But there is no diversity plan to the caller. Appreciate that question being posed by the caller. There is no diversity plan, and so consequently there is no specific guaranteed percentage of what the African American or specifically the diversity goal should be. Because of the large number of white firefighters in smaller departments, suburban departments, rural departments, and et cetera, throughout Minnesota, Wisconsin, even the Dakotas, the number will probably be around 50 retirees over a 3 or 4 or 5 year period. These men are not going to leave these jobs, if you will, on a moment's notice. These are well-paying jobs with great hours, if you will, though there is certainly a lot of danger to these first responders, these firefighters. But there's been a lot of loose talk by leadership, so-called leadership in these cities, once again trying to convey to the African-American population that there will be opportunity. This is in the case recruitment that will begin for firefighters in the Minneapolis Fire Department. But there will be no large number. We would anticipate no more than 3 to 4 to 5 out of that 60 African Americans, if that many, if you will. And the process is extremely rigid for those that are familiar with recruitment as it pertains to the fire service, as it is professionally referred to. So to the caller's question, there will not be a significant flow of African Americans into the Minneapolis Fire Department. The reason is no diversity plan, no commitment. It's not going to happen, if you will. Back to our discussion on the NRA and the proposal yesterday by the president of the NRA that we place police officers in every school here in America, if you will. We were touching on the fact that we just don't think that it will happen as long as there is no discussion about what it is that scares NAR members, NRA members, as it pertains to the threat, if you will. As a longtime member and familiar with the NRA, going back to the 1960s, I know that it's people that look like me, if you will. It is the African-American community. Anyways, as we said, the phone line, our special line is open, 763-228-1748, for anyone that has any question about the NRA proposal, if you will. Front page of the major newspapers, talking in terms of NRA leader urges armed guards in every U.S. school. That was the headline. By the way, NRA didn't seem to have an ability to protect its own press conference there yesterday as a number of protesters slipped in and disrupted the press conference there. I found it amusing how it was very large African-American, you know, security guards that ushered the people out the door with proper restraint and respect for their First Amendment rights, if you will. But I still found it amazing that the security guards in civilian clothes that were posted were African Americans, because deep inside of the NRA, there is really not a lot of love or specific trust for African Americans, of African Americans, and certainly there's not a lot of respect for African Americans. But they will take your money if you want to be a member, and if you know how to play the game and you know how to disguise your membership application, oops, you can certainly get in, and as we said earlier on this program, get the necessary materials, if you will, and actually hear the kind of dialogue. You know, in fact, we used to laugh back in the day when we would go to NRA conferences and conventions. You know, as black men, we'd always have cowboy boots and stuff. I don't even wear cowboy hats. And always have good stories about that we had come out of basically rural areas, if you will, that we you know, weren't excited about living in the urban centers of America, if you will, that, you know, we believed in patriotism and God's country, if you will, and we just kind of understood we weren't necessarily God's children, but we were just happy to be close to God's children, if you know what I mean. All a part of a covert operation that infiltrated the NRA many, many, many years ago. Anyways, that number, 763-228-1748. Again, this is Ari Edwards. I am co-host with my associate and fellow co-host, Donald Allen, who is traveling in the eastern part of the United States, if you will. Phone line is open for any question that you may have with respect to the proposal by the National Rifle Association to arm, quote-unquote, or to have in every school. And by the way, here in Minneapolis, and they're kind of trying to keep this quiet, we already have some teachers who have taken up arms, if you will. In fact, at a school called Stewart here in South Minneapolis, we had a female teacher, 21 years, if I'm not mistaken. She came to school with a .357 Magnum. One of her colleagues saw her putting it in her locker and notified school authorities, and she was suspended with pay. But, you know, her representatives have already said that, you know, this is a part of dealing with the threat, if you will, to the safety of children. Now, I have a bad feeling that this concern about the safety of children doesn't expand to African Americans, and the reason is as many children and babies that Black America has lost, if you will, in this country just in the last decade through the urban violence and et cetera, fighting over the drug trade and et cetera, if you will, in which Black America is merely a quote-unquote purchaser, if you will, of the drugs, just like Black Americans are the purchasers of the weapons, because Black Americans don't own any gun manufacturing facilities, if you will, don't have any gun manufacturing plants in the middle of their urban communities turning out thousands and thousands of weapons of death. And so we are merely a consumer, if you will, you know, just kind of there to buy it up. But what has concerned me was, and I watched this summer very closely, and I concur with the Reverend Al Sharpton, who has been on the ground, if you will, in some of these situations, as well as he was on the ground in Newtown, Connecticut. But Reverend Sharpton and many of us in this country who have a platform, if you will, you know, raise the question about where is the concern and the anxiety and the heartbreak with respect to so many African-American children dying in the violence. Now, I know what the argument always is, and that is, well, you're killing your own people. Well, when you look at the mass murderers, with the exception of the Asian gentleman at Virginia Tech and the D.C. sniper, all of these mass murderers in the United States over time have all been Caucasians, have all been white. And you see no one enter into a discussion, if you will, about the fact that these, quote-unquote, white predators are killing their own kind, though in many of these incidents, I think back to the McDonald's where in San Diego, if you will, I think of Aurora, I think of Columbine, I think of Fort Hood. That Fort Hood situation, though, has been a real embarrassment, and I should have also identified that the Army major was of Muslim descent, if you will, to the extent of his religious practices and et cetera. But he had attained a significant rank of major in the United States Army when he went on a rampage there at Fort Hood. Now, that was really the first time I saw the attempt by the conservative media in America to suggest group identification, if you will, that he had carried out a terrorist attack. Now, Fort Hood was oftentimes referred to as a terrorist attack when, you know, mass murders in places like Texas, you know, the Texas Tower there on the campus of the University of Texas in Austin, or the many others, large and small, if you will, Jonesboro, Arkansas, Springfield, Oregon, if you will, Minneapolis, Minnesota. I mean, you know, we have been missed here. I know that the mayor and others are somewhat upset with that. We have a call. Yes, caller. And what is your specific question, sir, caller? The caller said something very profound, that people kill people. Guns don't, well, by and large, don't shoot by themselves, per se, unless you're on a surface ship or, you know, a submarine or a Triton or something like that. You know, that's a good point, sir, that it's people that kill people, be it with a gun or be it with a knife or hatchet or a blunt instrument or a car or a bomb or a series of bombs. Excellent point. Do you have another specific question? Thank you, caller. Appreciate it, and we'll get on top of that. Thank you. Bye-bye. Another caller out of Minneapolis, out of our enclave, if you will, raised an interesting question about the amount of money. And I can assume that this caller, who we've had call us periodically over the last couple of years, is raising the issue that I know I raise as a journalist, and that when I hear the discussion about, you know, number one, gun control, but also hear the discussion about we need to deal with the mental health concerns, and you're absolutely correct. You definitely need to deal with at what point does a person snap in this country. But his question had to do with the enormous amount of money. And I have to tell you, callers, that here in my enclave, in my little hamlet called the Twin Cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul and et cetera, a lot of money, man, a lot of money has been poured into our community to allegedly deal with violence, if you will. And just after the tornado that ripped through here in May of 2011, a tremendous amount of money came in. And I was interested at the amount of money that was provided by Hennepin County, which is the county in which the city of Minneapolis is located in, gave African-American leaders, if you will, a nice chunk of money, over 300 and some thousand, to do mental health studies on African-American children and their parents, or their, you know, as it pertains to the effects, the psychological and mental effects that the tornado had. Because for an urban tornado, which is basically rare, the tornado that came through here in May of 2011 was devastating. It displaced a lot of black people, many who have not been allowed to return, quote-unquote, to their neighborhoods and et cetera. And so I know we've watched with great interest over the years programs such as Operation Ceasefire, which comes out of allegedly Chicago, sponsored by Northwestern University, the University of Illinois, Chicago, a number of other kinds of businesses. See, what we never really talk about the mental health thing is the pharmaceutical lobby. Oops. Because the pharmaceutical lobby is very much interested in getting us really on top of and really much involved in mental health via medication, if you will. Now, of course, black Americans have been exposed to their extreme detriment with regards to experimental medicine, Tuskegee, numerous studies on other kinds of diseases like sickle cell and et cetera. But if you can start playing with the brain, you know, hear what they've done here in Minneapolis is they give the mothers $25 in candy. I mean, really, I'm being serious here today on point. Give them a $25 stipend candy, and we have a renowned researcher here affiliated with the University of Minnesota who has been very much involved in, quote-unquote, making sure that mental health programs and protocols are in place to deal with the minds of the little black people. His name is Dr. Dante Cicchetti, for those of you up in Rochester, New York, involved in the Mount Hope Project up there. Y'all remember Dr. Cicchetti, if you will. Kind of looks like Tiny Tim. Cat likes to wear them leather suits and things. I mean, it kind of makes me wonder who's unbalanced here, you know what I mean? But Dr. Cicchetti was rolled in here about 3 years ago, a little over 3 years ago now. University of Minnesota acquired a significant grant, stipends, if you will, and the university has been working on the mental health problems, quote-unquote, of the African-American here in the Twin Cities. And leadership has sent word out that they do not expect any, quote-unquote, criticism or examination on what Dr. Cicchetti. For those of you that maybe are having a problem finding him on your website and et cetera, you need to go to the book Medical Apartheid, a book done by an African-American as part of her really thesis on health care and mental care in America. You need to read particularly that portion that deals with a very interesting program that was initiated in New York City, particularly in the Bronx of the Queens of Queens and the Bronx. Columbia University, very much involved in this quote unquote experimental medicine, if you will. And as we said earlier, Black America has had some terrible experiences with experimental medicine being directed towards the African American community over the last 100 years, if you will. And of course, historically in this nation, we in Black America talk in terms of that which was the Tuskegee experiment, in which probably, when you talk in terms of the lapse and how it spilled over, we probably have over 20,000 Negroes infected through the Veterans Administration, by the way, and public health in the area of Tuskegee, Alabama, in the mid-1930s. In fact, it actually began to come to the forefront during the period of time of the Scottsboro Boys trial, which was at the same period of time there in 1934, 35, 36. Tuskegee was going on. It was 11, 12 years later when a white researcher at, of all places, the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, who exposed the Tuskegee experiment, though a number of black medical practitioners, if you will, had wrote about it in their comings and goings with the National Medical Association, which is the black, because for a long time, you know, blacks couldn't belong to the American Medical Association, if you will. National Medical Association was the colored medical association. A lot of papers were developed by many, many fine black medical minds in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s about this experiment. And then, of course, we all know the history, the very fine book, the excellent book, The River, that was printed after 10 years of research by a man by the name of Hooper, which talked in terms of where HIV and AIDS really came from, you know, starting in Germany with respect to Nazi scientists. Project moved to the United States, first New Jersey, then later outside of San Francisco, got out of control. The United States cuts a deal with the Belgians. Program is relocated to the Congo, if you will, and it has never been the same in Central, or like we like to say, middle black Africa, if you will. In fact, maybe as a point of serious discussion, though African Americans are discouraged from discussions about this, for those of you that can find it, it is a 3,000-page book, by the way. Tremendous research by Mr. Hooper. You may want to try to obtain the book. We can tell you it's extremely difficult to find nowadays, but you know, we will still try to do that. Yes, caller. Hello? Hello, caller. Brother James, how you doing, my brother? Let me see if I can make sure I get you in. We're doing kind of a makeshift today. Okay, let me, what's your question? I'm going to make sure the listening audience can hear it. Go on, Brother James, what's your question?
You remember there was an experiment done where the young lady from Penn State back here in March the 11th of 2011, she did a research on how discrimination creates racial battle fatigue for African Americans, and especially here in Minnesota with the 181, and then they did a little bit more in-depth shows how individuals of African American can go from racial discrimination on the job to straight into mental health.
Brother James, want to thank you on that. I'm going to have to research that. I remember that. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I remember a call from you and a couple others way back then raising that question. I know that that kind of research went on. I didn't remember if she was affiliated with Penn State or not, but I know that it went on. I know that the hypothesis, if you will, is just what you said with respect to an examination of the mental status of African Americans. That was put back into play by a group of so-called African American health specialists, when the county's 200 and some thousand, then later almost 350,000 was brought into play in North Minneapolis and then expanded. You're one of the few people that remembers that kind of activity. But yes, it happened. There is some empirical data that was accumulated. It is in the hands of Dr. Jaquette, and the University of Minnesota. And if it was Penn State, I don't want to, you know, slander Penn State, but if it was Penn State, as you've indicated, there was kind of a joint project, and I think also Dr. Cicchetti's former medical partner, Columbia University in New York City, was very much involved with this. Okay?
Yeah, and you were talking about that medical apartheid. I think that's by a young lady by the name of Harriet A. Washington.
That is absolutely correct, sir. I wanted to draw someone out. Appreciate you calling her here out of Minneapolis. That's just who she was. She is an excellent researcher. Eminent credentials, and that book is still the talk of the black medical world, if you will. You're absolutely correct, sir. All right?
So that book was also discontinued out of the Minneapolis. They do it, too, also. You might want to mention that, too. That's why a lot of people here don't know a lot of things, because that book was discontinued out of Minneapolis Public Library.
You are. my caller, James, is... Got you. All right. James, appreciate it, man. Thanks for the call. Appreciate you on the call. Thank you, sir. All right. Brother James calling out of Minneapolis, reminding us of the book by Miss Washington. That is the book, Medical Apartheid. Again, our phone lines are open through our special number. Again, 763-228-1748. I am co-host Ron Edwards. My associate, Mr. Allen, is traveling in the East. We've gotten into a discussion. The genesis is the National Rifle Association's comments yesterday in a press conference in Washington, D.C., which was interrupted, which meant that NRA's security was penetrated, if you will. Some protesters showed up. But this last caller, real deep observations, and had his historical information in place. The book Medical Apartheid by a great African-American female researcher, Miss Washington, if you will. The caller out of Minneapolis pointed out that that book, the book of Medical Apartheid, was discontinued in the Minneapolis Public Library, cannot be found, including the Sumner Library, which is in the heart of the African-American community in North Minneapolis. I have been told that that book cannot be attained, if you will. And that then takes us back to the book, The River, a journey to the source of HIV and AIDS, if you will, Edward Hooper. By the way, keep those names in mind, Miss Washington, if you will. I think she is a doctor, a PhD. Edward Hooper, the book The River. New York Times made a interesting critique, if you will, of the book. As we said, the book is over 3,000 pages. Discontinued printing here in the United States. In fact, the current copy that we were able to obtain just a year ago through operatives actually was purchased by us in London, England, and then filtered through another source in Long Beach, California. I mean, I thought, I was asking for the Pentagon Papers, if you know what I mean. But we have the book, Edward Hooper, the book The River. The book lays out the analysis, if you will, the hypothesis for the HIV, but in the course of that, as the book The Medical Apartheid does, it talks in terms of the psychological testing, probing, and programs that need to be in place to get people's minds right to accept, quote-unquote, these programs of genocide. And by the way, that was what happened in Tuskegee. We know there have been a couple plays that talk about a couple of courageous black nurses during that time, 1933, 34, 35. There have been a couple plays, a couple books that talk about the pain and the agony of African-American veterans, African-American men, veterans of the First World War, by the way, and what they suffered through. how the government covered it up. As we said earlier, it was not until a white professor at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, after a 2 or 3 year study, revealed and wrote about and actually delivered a position paper, they like to call it a white paper, on the American government's roles in experimental medicine. Now, you remember about a year ago, the United States got busted behind doing some similar genocidal experiments of medicine in Central America, and I think in both Guatemala and Honduras, and had been doing it for quite some time. It appears that that's one of the doctrines of our national agenda as it pertains to experimental medicine. We like to pretend that we are involved in helping the indigenous populations of these little quote-unquote backward countries, if you will. By the way, I hate to say it because you never want to see lives lost, though the majority of the people that were killed in Pakistan a couple of days ago were Pakistanis, if you will. The whole thing about polio vaccine orally and et cetera, that's fascinating because in the book, The River, how the journey of HIV and AIDS actually began was that in 1952-53, the Belgium government indicated, along with what was the new fledgling World Health Organization, that they were going to begin inoculation and vaccinations to deal with the problem of polio in the Congo, the Black Congo. And that's how the virus was given to Black Africans, if you will, through the particularly the polio sock vaccine that was given orally. In other words, you know, you give it in a little cup and some water and you drank it. Well, unfortunately, it was one of the most disastrous diseases that mankind has ever faced, uncurable, really, if you will. Oh, it's all here in the book The River, just as it's all there in the book Medical Apartheid by Dr. Washington, one of the preeminent researchers in America, who's an African-American woman, who actually was chided, if you will, and criticized for her research, though there were different panels that examined her work, if you will, which is something that you have to subject yourself to. You have to stand and defend, quote-unquote, your position, if you will, your enunciations and et cetera. Dr. Washington did that, and so did Edward Hooper. At a conference sponsored by the United Nations in Montreal, Canada. Oh, it's all here. It's been known to us for over a decade. We first actually learned about it through our very good friend Dick Gregory when we were on a panel with him here in the Twin Cities, and it was one of the finest experiences that I know that I enjoyed with Dick Gregory, sponsored by a man by the name of Rex Marshall, who was the founder of Kwanzaa in this part of the country. But Mr. Marshall also used to put on tremendous forums, if you will, in our city back in 1979 and 80 and 81. And I had the pleasure of being on a panel with Dick Gregory at International Market Square in North Minneapolis. And Dick laid it out on where this HIV thing came from. A little over 10 years later, Edward Hooper released his 10-year study, in which, by the way, every one of the assistants, individuals that assisted Edward Hooper with this 10-year study, all had died. In fact, there is a prelogue at the end of this book, The River, by Edward Hooper, that talks about standing on high ground in Uganda with the father of a young man who had started out with Mr. Hooper as a part of the research over a decade prior. And that young man had died as an outgrowth of being infected with HIV. And Edward Hooper says in this prelogue that they stood looking out at the sunset, if you will, and the father discussing the legacy of his son, who had such a brilliant career, but unfortunately succumbed to HIV. And a very controlled program of the insertion of this disease into the Black population in the Congo and throughout Central Congo and throughout Central Black Africa, just as it has been done here in the United States. Excellent book. Again, Medical Apartheid by Washington, Dr. Washington, The River by Hooper, two documents that give you a clear understanding of where maybe we're going. A couple of callers ago, we had a gentleman who had done his homework, Brother James, as we call him affectionately, laid out the experimental documentation. In fact, our mayor in 2009, for those particularly that we're coming up on election here in 2013, people need to be reminded of Mayor R.T. Ryback's presentation to the National Conference of Mayors, in which Mayor R.T. Ryback was able to identify the fact that crime, this is interesting, crime was a mental health problem, acute and strongly existing within African Americans, if you will. In fact, the doctrine, if you will, and we have about, run, what is it, 11 minutes here on program? I'm sorry, 15. It is contained in a document published by the National League of Cities, the Institute for Youth Education and Families. It is entitled The State of City Leadership for Children and Families, and the date on it of publication and dissemination is 2009. And one needs to take a look at it, particularly given what Brother James, one of our callers, and two other callers clearly challenged us on here at On Point. And we would call your attention to pages 56, 57, and 58. And let me see. And the top of 59. And the position by the mayor of the city of Minneapolis that there must be a significant operational program to deal with the mental health problems of young, particularly African American males. By the way, some of the medicines and et cetera that are being used to quote unquote correct their mental deficiency will have a lot to do with your ability to reproduce children, Black America, Black Minnesota. And in some respects, it is in this document, very classified kind of document. We give it to you again. The State of City Leadership for Children and Families. The National League of Cities are the authors, and it is their institution or Institute for Youth Education and Families. Mayor R.T. Ryback laying out in this, I now call it a manifesto, dealing with youth violence prevention, you know, key goals, innovations, and et cetera. We have a call coming in. Hello? All right, let me get back to you. We're on the air. Call you right back. That was another call coming in. That particular call is a source that we don't want to expose at this particular point in time on the air. But again, we would encourage those of you that can access the website for the National League of Cities, Institute for Youth Education and Families, to take a look at the document. We'll identify it for the sixth time, The State of City Leadership for Families and Children's 2009, a manifesto presented at, on that particular occasion. And it is interesting, the statements attributed to the mayor, the current mayor of the city of Minneapolis. In fact, there is a kind of a preamble which talks in terms that Minneapolis has successfully reaffirmed youth violence as a public health issue. You see, this is one of the reasons that there's a significant and high level of comfort amongst law enforcement and other paramilitary groups operating in these cities with respect to what it is they do to Black youth, that Black youth represent a public health threat. That's right here. It's right here in the documents. Not anything that Brother Edwards is making up here on our program, On Point. It is contained in a manifesto that was released in 2009 as an outgrowth of a study done by a very prestigious group of Caucasians in this city, commissioned by the mayor sometime around 2007. When we first broke this story a couple years ago, we raised questions to some of those in our black medical community if, in fact, they were allowed or encouraged or invited to be members of this esteemed group that put together quite a doctrine that determined that African-American youth, particularly males, particularly black males, are a public health nuisance, if you will. They are a part of the threat to the public health of this beloved enclave of ours at the head of the Mississippi, if you will. See, our leaders agreed, some of them receiving compensation and payment, agreed a couple of years ago that they would do everything they could. I want you to follow this closely, and I know how much Brother James and others are aware of this, and you know, there's very few platforms that our black leaders, you know, and I was surprised at how many ministers agreed to this with the mayor at that time. They were all on the same page then. That there would be a well-crafted denunciation of anyone that chose to expose or attempt to engage or have community engage in discussions about the secret report of 2007 and the mayor's acceptance by the National League of Cities of his doctrine, of his philosophy, of his hypothesis that African Americans, particularly African American youth, were a public health threat, if you will. You see, what is so frightening about that is that there was a very courageous German who was executed by the Nazis in the 1930s, and I'm going to spell his name for you, for those of you that are out there. He was also a theologian and et cetera. Bonhoeffer, spelled B-O-N-H-O-E-F-F-E-R. He was a pastor. He was a prophet, if you will. Some say that he was a spy, but he was executed by the Nazis. But he laid out a tremendous manifesto talking in terms of how the Nazis, how neo-Nazis put into play. If there's any questions, feel free to give us an immediate call on the special line that we have opened for this. 763-228-1748. Again, I'm co-host Ron Edwards, sitting in singly today. My co-host, Mr. Allen, is traveling in the East. But Mr. Bonhoeffer laid out and exposed, and of course it cost him his life, if you will, in 1937, if I'm not mistaken. He laid out how the Nazis, working with the mental health and other health organizations in our, in Nazi Germany, began to talk in terms of this extermination, but how the intellectual rationale would be crafted and move forward. The portion of his book that entitled The Foreword is in prologue is frightening, if you will, because the Allies at some point in time in 1945 and 46, and used some of it in the Nuremberg trials, if you will, not the Nuremberg laws of 1935, 36, 37, but the Nuremberg trials of 1946, 47, 48, the Joint Allied Command identified some of this, and this is one of the reasons that the doctors who had been involved in creating the HIV vaccines and AIDS vaccines, if you will, that would, you know, quote unquote, kill people, were considered to be a prize trophy. In fact, there was a rush that went on between the United States and the Russians because both of them were trying to get their hands on the United States, the French, and the British were able to get a hold of them, get them out of Germany, if you will. And as we said, they first set up operations at a facility in New Jersey. And there's a whole history of that. But no one is supposed to talk about Dr. or Pastor Bonhoeffer, who also had a significant background in our social science and et cetera. And so we are aware that after the manifesto was delivered by the mayor of this city to the National League of Cities in 2009, in which we repeat again the mayor's declaration and the acceptance of that declaration that in his city, Minneapolis, and it's at page it's at page 58 for those of you that would want to dispute what quote-unquote Black Rasputin is laying out to you. I read it again. Minneapolis has successfully reaffirmed youth violence as a public health issue through a excessive process of planning and community engagement. In fact, in the manifesto, the mayor laid out some of those of you in my community who say you are leaders, the roles that you accepted and the payout that you accepted in order to advance this hypothesis, if you will, which has run rampant through this city since 2007 and is the genesis for significant physical action taken against African Americans in this city. It is frightening. And then yet we go back to Pastor Bonhoeffer, Bonhoeffer. Tremendous manifesto. Frightened of the Nazi regime to death. There was concern, but then it was all suppressed, particularly after he was murdered, you know, assassination style. But what has troubled us since we came into possession of certain documents upon exhaustive examination and et cetera, when we found these documents and et cetera that were well hid, if you will, when we began to compare them to other documents that we have accumulated in our own career of research and as a historian, and then we began to see at long last books such as The River, books such as Medical Apartheid, the manifestos and et cetera of Bonhoeffer, our own knowledge of agreements in principle that were reached here starting in 2007 with respect to identifying the African-American population as a threat to the well-being and the health of the African-American community. We became very concerned, but then we were confronted with behind walls and closed doors and et cetera, that an agreement had been reached. Monies had been received from our leaders, if you will, in the ecumenical and organizational sectors and et cetera. Different little groups that had been put together for the purpose of carrying out the will of the mayor and others in this policy, this genocidal policy against the African-American community. And it has confirmed and definitely confirmed and strengthened itself, particularly, and it was interesting, it took a tornado. And the decision to make some money off the tornado that caused this to really expose itself, if you will. Well, we're wrapping down the last 2 minutes. We appreciate you spending the time. We certainly appreciate the calls from callers from here in the Twin Cities and around the country. Have a great holiday for those of you that celebrate the holidays, but to the African-American communities of America, and particularly here in the Twin Cities and et cetera, continue to be vigilant, for that is the only way that you will be guaranteed some semblance of safety for you and yours, and particularly for you mothers and fathers out there. Watch very closely what is being proposed as it pertains to helping your community and your family with the problems that you're suffering, the strain and stress of what it is that you're feeling. There is a master plan that has been in place for a long time. Again, on behalf of my co-host, Mr. Don Allen, we appreciate the opportunity to have come in to your homes, to your living rooms, via the computer, if you will. We will be back next week. Again, I'm Ron Edwards, and this is the Black Political Program, if you will, On Point. Take care.